Hello, hello, everyone. I'm super excited because Dr. Neil Shaw is here, one of my friends, one of the people that I talk leadership to, which I'm grateful for. And you're now on the Black Doula podcast. So Dr. Neil Shaw, would you like to introduce yourself? And also, what do you want me to call you when we're like on air?
You call me whatever you want to call me. Just call me Neil.
Yeah, I don't, listen, I'm not a doctor. I don't know how y'all feel about things.
No, I mean, the thing about the doctor title is, I think there's some, like when you're with patients, they prefer it because it's disconcerting otherwise. Mm-hmm. Right? A lot of times, it depends on the person, but I found, mm-hmm. I remember like when I was a brand new doctor, I wasn't used to the title yet. So I just introduced myself to patients as Neil and they were like, what do you mean, Neil? Are you Dr. Shaw? there are settings for everything, but I think because we're friends and because this is a free-flowing conversation, be Neil.
Yes. Well, Neil, can you welcome yourself? Give us all the magic that you do.
Sure. I am a dad. I've got a four-year-old and a six-year-old. I had to gut check that because they just turned four and six. And I also spent most of my career delivering babies as an obstetrician. And I was a professor as well. And then about a year and a half ago, I gave all my grants away. You know, a little bit of pandemic ennui, a little bit of midlife crisis, but decided that I was going to take a brand new job as the chief medical officer of Maven Clinic, which is the largest digital health clinic for women and families in the world.
So you're doing a lot.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, like a three-ring circus. Or how many rings are in a circus? I don't know. All the rings. You have all the rings at home. There's a dog.
Haven't seen your kids.
Really? We Zoom so much. They're in school for another like hour.
You have to send me pictures because I like have not seen them because we always meet on Zoom, but it's always during like work time or whatever it is.
Oh, I'll take care of that right after we're done.
How is it being a dad and a doctor? Like, do you ever look at your kids and like diagnose things or like do you ever
all
like...
All the time. But my wife doesn't trust my diagnoses. She's always like, let's double check with the pediatrician. And I'm like, all right. But it also turns out, you know, like I'm at the end of the day, I'm a surgeon, so I'm not that useful around the house unless someone needs like an amputation or something. So,
okay. I have a thing about surgery. Like, so I've had surgeries actually when I had my fiber removal. So I had an open abdominal fiber removal 5 years ago. And before then I was like, oh, I could deal with blood. I was in the medical field. I dealt with blood. I dealt with this. I dealt with that. But I remember the first time I went to a C-section after my own surgery and I was sick. I was like, oh my God, I'm about to pass out. Like, I can't even do this. What was your motivation to be like, I need to cut up some bodies and help them work a little better if I do a little thing?
First of all, on the blood front, it's all context, you know, like the first time I was ever in an operating room, I hit the floor, you know, so it took like some training getting used to, but, and C-sections are a lot of blood.
A lot of blood. So I was like, oh my gosh. And I had an open abdominal, so you know, similar. And I was like,
I mean, not to frighten anybody who's listening. I mean, it's called the Black Doula podcast. So I assume there are a lot of doulas around who know.
Yeah, we're fine. We're unfiltered.
But I mean, like, you know, we've got 5 liters of blood in our bodies. And the placenta is an organ that only exists in pregnancy. It gets 25% of everything the heart is pumping and is a big bag of blood vessels. So when it comes out, even under normal conditions, like an average C-section can be like a liter of blood. So it's a lot. It's a lot. And so anyway, how did I decide I wanted to cut people open? I mean, it was never from like a violent perspective. It was always from like a fascination perspective. And just, I love the tangibility of it. The fact that you can see in front of you what you're trying to fix and then solve it. And then I guess I always kind of liked the thrill of like, you know, you never know what you're going to find when you look beneath the layers.
I've had a couple when I had my second surgery. I don't know if you noticed about me, but I had I had to open abdominal. Then I had a second surgery a year later because my bowel had attached to my uterus, scar tissue. So I had to get that. But also when it went in, it was also scar tissue around my bladder and like, not my bladder, my intestine had connected to my uterus. There we go. And so it was just like a lot, but also just, it's such a surprise when you cut into the body. But I'm the weirdo. When I had my fibroid taken out, I asked my surgeon, Dr. Madden, I was like, can you give me a picture? So there's literally a picture of like my fibroid when it came out. It looks like a big kidney bean. It was a mess.
Well, we're glad that you're through that.
Yeah. But anyway, so one of the things that I really appreciate about you is that like you, I think, especially in the birth world and out of hospital, like care and providers, there's always this conversation around like doctors being so inaccessible, right? And like, and not, and also like one, because they're busy, but two, because because they just don't want nothing to do with doulas or anything that is not specifically in that medical model. And so one of the things I appreciate you that you've always been a doctor and a person who is like, let's have the conversation together. There's things I can learn from you. There's things we can learn from each other. So on and so forth. Right. And that's just not, I mean, I feel like the tides are turning to a certain space. Like there are doctors who are now very much in support of doulas and even home births or whatever it is. But I guess, like, when did you become that person that was like, I am loving all of this? Because I imagine, like, medical school surgery is very, it's in this one system, right? In a system that, I don't want to say, it's kind of a silo from the other things that are at work. So, like, when did that happen for you where you were like, doulas and midwives and things?
Good question. I agree. I think that the tides are turning. And I don't think that most obstetricians intend to be like siloed or closed off. I think there's a number of reasons for why things are the way they are. And generally, mm-hmm. my philosophy in life is that a bad system will beat a good person every time. For myself, I think I did my OBGYN rotation first in medical school to get it over with because I was a dude in my early 20s. And there was no way that that's what I was going to do. So I was like, this is my thing to like get used to the hospital, get it over with, and then just move on to like surgery, my surgery rotation or something else that seemed exciting. So I didn't expect it, but on my first week ever as a medical student in the hospital, I was at Women and Infants Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island, and my teachers were midwives. Mm-hmm. I think I gravitated towards like the work itself. Like I thought that birth was really incredible. And also the people that did the work. I wanted to be more like them. I just like naturally gravitated towards them. I think to be a midwife or a doula, I think you've got to be a little bit punk rock, right? You've got to like, you've got to care deeply, but you have to be intentionally going against the existing grain. And I also think like in my background, I mean, I grew up in a multi-generational household where my parents are straight-laced immigrants. And as a rule, they just follow the rules. They're very careful. My grandparents were involved in the effort to like decolonize India. And so like they, you know, I grew up with a healthy respect for radical thought and also like the kind of pragmatism that makes an Indian kid go to medical school from New Jersey. Anyway, so that was my orientation. So I, and then there was like a series of things that happened in my career where I became an OB. I was always thought I was the odd one out. Like there were 11 people in my residency class. And I was like, I was the 11th choice. And so like, I was like this male OB in like a female dominated space. And I think like just genuinely came at it with a lot of humility and felt like, for example, on the labor and delivery floor, it's really common to have nurses that have been there for decades. And I was like an intern. I didn't know anything. So like they were my teachers, you know, so on and so forth. And then I think there was one inflection point in particular in my career where in the UK, I was like brand new faculty at Harvard and the UK put out a report that said it was safer to have a baby at home with a midwife than in the hospital with an obstetrician. Safer. And the New England Journal of Medicine, which is like really prestigious, high impact journal, invited me to write a response to that, or to write a perspective on it. Brand new. And I was like, I don't know if I agree with this. It's like, I don't want to wade into this controversial thing so early in my career. And then my mentor encouraged me to like really dig into like why that recommendation came out. And I came out with a point of view that it was safer in the UK. And there were a mm-hmm. bunch of things in the US that may or may not make it safer, but we've got to fix. I wrote something that was really popular with midwives and got to meet a lot of them. And then that's how it started.
Well, that's wild because that was early in your career and like taking that stance. Because I imagine, like this is me imagining, because I'm not a physician. I'm a doula, but I'm not that. So I imagine, and I always wonder, I should say, like in your, you know, space of being an OB, if there's opposition to the way that you do your work and your treatment from other OBs who are like, no, that's not how we do it.
Oh, 100%. I think originally when I was starting to say things that were controversial in the field, I didn't know that I was being as, I think I knew I was being controversial, but I didn't think I understood the stakes. Mm-hmm. It was easier early in my career where I had less to quote unquote lose. So, you know, I would go out on big platforms and say things. And then I think there were a few moments where I was intentional and I got away with it. Like, I think it was the 2017 ACOG meeting. I got to do the keynote for the whole thing. And it was, you know, like thousands of obstetricians in the room. And I lectured them about why the C-section rate was too high. I mean, I did it in a kind way, I think, in a way mm-hmm. that I really tried to make compelling and all of that. But at the end of the day, I was telling them that they were not, we were not moving in the right direction. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Honestly, like that got an applause line. You know, obstetricians are human beings and they care. Yeah. And they're good actors in bad systems for the most part. And so that made me braver and braver over time. And then sure. I think back about like the home birth versus hospital debates that I've been in. They were not nearly as controversial as the things I did on the latter end of my career. You know, and so, and I've struggled with it, to be honest with you. It's not like I've got this huge stable of courage that's enabled me to do it. I think if anything, like I had, as I've gotten further in my career and really understood the stakes and the consequences of, you know, like at the end of the day, I guess this is what I think. If you're not pissing people off somewhere, you're probably not leading. And I guess over my career, I've developed a philosophy that in some ways, leadership is about spending down your power and your influence, and sometimes even your welcome.
You're welcome. That part. And yes, because yeah, totally understanding, especially like, cause you know, well, not all, it's so wild. Cause I sometimes doulas actually aren't into like advocacy, which is like weird to me, but that's the truth. But I've definitely like had similar experiences in the sense of, you know, having opinions and thoughts that I want to put forward in my, you know, in my space that I inhabit, and also being afraid in the process. And I think like that is, you know, I have this tattoo on my shoulder. It says live fearlessly, right? And I got it like several years ago. And I was like, I don't know if I'm living fearlessly. I just do it. I'm scared as hell. But if this is going to actually move us to a point that we can have a conversation about what really matters and really make some actions around that, then I'm willing to do it. And that's like, you know, it's about like community, right? Because it's also like, you know, you have your privileges. I have my privileges. And some of the things that we sometimes like fight for, or sometimes they're not directly connected to us, right? But it's like utilizing your privilege and your access and your education to be a trailblazer, as people say. So thank you for that. So I wanted to get into some thoughts about the future of birth. So one of the things that I struggle, and we've had conversations around this, it's just like there's a lot of work being done, and there is work that is definitely shifting the way that we do things. But I also think there's like things that we have to work on as far as like being able to communicate with everyone on a birth team, and even our own trauma that we need to deal with, right, in this work. So the one thing I want to kind of start the conversation with is I have a huge problem with like the silos that we work in. Like, you know, the doulas know the doulas, and the midwives, sometimes the midwife, depending on what kind of midwife, they do a doula, you know, but like then there's the midwives, and then there's the doctors, and then there's the separation. And in that separation, I'm like, it's so much knowledge being missed, right? Because obviously, I don't know what you know as a doctor, but it's also things that you don't know as a doula, right? And the way that I approach care is going to be different from how you approach care. The models are going to be different. So my question to you is like, how do you envision us being able to actually come together, right, across different disciplines? And what do you think that will require?
That's a great question. I mean, I think I spent most of my career thinking about how that worked, like literally on the labor floor, on the labor delivery room, and how you can make communication more seamless between, you know, the birthing person and their family and the different kinds of providers that are there, inclusive of doulas, midwives, nurses, obstetricians, all of it. And then, you know, I spent part of my career thinking about how to stitch together like that interprofessional coalition with birth moms. And and I think, you know, the way that I'm thinking about it now is even broader as I think about how I'm positioned at Maven Clinic and, you know, our clients, which are large national payers and corporations across the cultural spectrum, industry spectrum, political spectrum, all of it. And I think the way that I would answer it now is that what we need is a common vision and set of values. That is like needs to be like what we anchor to. And I have a point of view on what that looks like. But then when it comes to strategies, goals, tactics, we have to be open and realize that, you know, in terms of positionality, not only do we have different power and privileges, but we're just literally positioned to do different things. There are community-based organizations across the country right now that are positioned to be more radical than I can be at Maven Clinic. Mm-hmm. And then I've got to hold space for the fact that like that's necessary and that we need them to do that. And also they give me cover to come behind them and sort of like, but like, you know, I am an institutional actor working company. And so I've got to use that position differently to have an influence. But I think the challenge of the moment is that we're, you know, it takes even more. What concerns me the most is it takes more courage in 2022, I think, to be that person who's willing to step out and say what they think than I think it did a couple of years ago. And I think that's really, really concerning. We've got to make space for different approaches, different perspectives.
Yeah, for sure. And so the thing that popped into my head, like when you said that, was the world in 2020 was like, oh my gosh, we love Black people, right? It was like, we got to do thing. for, you know, people of color, we got to do this thing. And there was like a lot of, you know, in the space that we inhabit as far as like birth and all that, like there was a lot of, you know, conversation and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And now, you know, 2 years later, almost 2023 at this point, like, where did that all go? You know, where did it all go? And so I am like, I guess, like, what is your opinion about like even that transition in the last 2 years? Because, you know, it's a lot of, especially like, I know a lot of people that do education and do these things, and they were like popping in 2020, right? Even 2021, but now things are drying up, right? And I'm talking about people who do education and like medical systems and all that kind of stuff. So I guess, like, what are your feelings about that time and where we are now? And if you're seeing the slowdown in the effort around, you know, making birth better for Black folks, Brown folks, Indigenous folks, so on.
I mean, I would say, I think people across the board are tired, particularly people who are doing justice work. And I think that part of the tiredness is, you know, the macro forces in the world. But I think part of it, honestly, is that we're cannibalizing each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, that's the part that concerns me.
Can you speak to that a little bit more? Cannibalizing each other, like, what you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think, again, I think there's a tendency to, like, subject each other to purity tests that are based on, mm-hmm. you know, a dominant opinion mm-hmm. rather than, and, like, you know, I'm not a Black birth worker. I'm mm-hmm. not in that in the same way. I'm someone who tries to be an ally, doesn't necessarily always get it right, though, but has, like, the intent has been to be an ally. And I think an observer of, like, the overall space and movement. And I would say, you know, I think it was good about it, like, even ahead of summer 2020 and George Floyd, I think that there was a recognition that maternal mortality was going up. And the journalists who led to, who drove that broad public recognition always saw it through the lens of racial equity and anti-Black racism specifically. That was very, very helpful because it really, even ahead of George Floyd, I think, put things in the lexicon that hadn't been there. Like, I remember in 2019 having a panel at ACOG and using the word racism in the title, and it was super edgy, right? But in like 2022, it wouldn't be edgy, right? And that, to me, is like mm-hmm. a small progress. I don't know. I mean, I there were a couple of organizations that really dominated the space. And I think that they didn't necessarily represent everybody's point of view that was part of the movement. Mm-hmm. And I think that's mm-hmm. that's part of the challenge that I see, is that now we have a multiplicity of people who are working in a number of different ways. I do see a lot of funding going into the space overall, but it's not centralized in the same way. You know, the question over the next couple of years is, how do we stitch this into a movement that feels cohesive, that feels like it's making an impact? But I also think this is part of the natural progression. It was like, there's like one or two organizations who are getting all the attention, all the funding, one or two people associated with them. And mm-hmm. now there's an army being raised. There's hundreds, there's thousands. And that's great. That's the right direction. But then how do we come together again? I'm not sure.
For sure. And even when we talk about that come together, so you got a copy of my book. I don't think you read the whole thing yet. But I talk about in there, like, the aspect, the process of coming together means that we have to kind of, like, look beyond ourselves, right? Like, and, you know, one of the things I also say, like, when we talk about reproductive justice, we're also talking about reproductive justice for all, even the people that don't fuck with us, like, don't like us, don't whatever. And so I see, like, I guess, like, a part of the reason why I wrote my book was because I've been in organizing spaces where people are so in their own trauma cycle, right, their own situation, that we can't have the conversations we need to for the community wellness, right? Like, so there's, like, a, you know, I think, like, when we think about activism and the work that we do, or advocacy and the work that we do in different ways, there's also this aspect of, like, how much we are traumatized by this work, right? Like, how much we are traumatized by, you know, at least for me, going to births that were very traumatic, dealing with my own identity as a Black non-binary woman in the world, being a person who's had health issues, reproductive health, I have chronic pain, being a person who has a family and a thing and then this, right? But then wanting to come together with people around, like, how do we move it so that we can, like, make a better future for birthing people. So I guess, like, I would love for you to speak to your experience with, like, I mean, you went through COVID. I just imagine that was a wild time. I imagine that, like, just being an OB comes with its own trauma, its own experiences that are not always great. But, like, how do you deal with that?
I mean, those are great reflections. I mean, I imagine that most people enter into justice work, or maybe even reproductive justice specifically, to some degree from a position of their own trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to imagine it's part of the motivation for a lot of people. There's something personal there, and often it is trauma. And then I imagine that the work itself is regularly triggering. And the challenge with it, if you're not aware of it, you know,
I imagine that you, and even in the space that you're in now, that you go through traumatic pieces. Like in my book, I wrote about like a story that's a very average story around, unfortunately, around a Black woman dying in birth. And we talk about the characters, and one of the characters is a doctor who's not the most like welcoming person. But also later in the book, I get into why that is, right? Like his own trauma that he's dealt with as a doctor. And I think like a part of us coming together is humanizing each other, right? So just in your position and what you've been in through in between, I imagine that there's been trauma.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, like, I don't necessarily have the words to like unpack the mm-hmm. my like, personal trauma, but I can say that, like, I appreciate you acknowledging the opportunity that we have to humanize each other better, because I think that the challenge with trauma is it makes us less empathetic. You know, understanding that it can be harder to project empathy when you hold less power than, you know, other folks. But, you know, for example, like last week, we did a screening of Aftershock at Columbia Medical Center. So we were in New York. We were really close to one of the hospitals where one of the main characters' partners lost her life, you know, and the film, and we screened it in like the biggest auditorium at the medical center for doctors and nurses, most of whom were white, a few of which were of color, and then even fewer were Black. And, you know, it was interesting to have the conversation in that space because, you know, the film was triggering for a lot of people in the room, but for different reasons, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there are people that were directly impacted by the maternal mortality crisis. And there are people who honestly, I think, feel caught in the crosshairs of it.
It's so much just like, and I tell people, like, one of the things that I say that we are tasked with, especially like people who are like myself and yourself, where we're trying to change it, right? And like hopefully improve it for the next generations and generations to come, is that it's hard to be tasked with being in a system and being of it no matter how you try. Like we're here on earth, so we're here, we're in it, you know what I mean? But also having to build a new one at the same time, right? And especially when it's not the simple, like just knock everything down, even though I understand that, like, you know, like that's the desire, it's not happening that way. You know, like these things that are standing, these institutions, these theories, these whatever, have to be shifted from like an inner, you know, inner space or whatever. And I feel like that's kind of like your role, right? Like, I feel like I'm the person who's like, I'm a little bit more removed, but also I am a person who likes to, so this is how we're in conversation, but I feel like there's also this responsibility that you have to be inside it and changing it from the inside. Does that make sense?
It does. And that's what I meant by like different people and groups having different roles to play. But I think, you know, there's a really important role that people are playing in pushing from the outside for revolution. And then there's people that have a really important role from the inside that are pushing for evolution, which is a little bit of a different approach. But mm-hmm. I think, you know, the challenge for me actually has been, you know, being a male obstetrician, Harvard professor, you know, I'm melanated, but there's mm-hmm. there's no shortage of South Asian doctors. Let's be honest. And so like, I know what it's like to be a brown person in America. And I also do have patients that come to me like looking for solidarity in, mm-hmm. but also like, you know, I've got a clear sense of belonging in the medical establishment. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. And also, so some of the things that I say, they get me in trouble with like the institutional actors, like they're really controversial. Like, you know, there are parts of Aftershock, the film, that are very controversial, as you can imagine. And then there are other things that I do where I think for people who are disenfranchised, don't go far enough. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's always that line where you feel like, you know, everybody's mad at you potentially. And you've got to kind of hold a position that can be hard.
Yes. But then I hope that, like, you know, those times that are hard, I aim to lean into my humanness. I'm like, let me go be a daughter. Let me go be a friend. Let me go do this. Right. And I think, at least for me, and like, we've had many conversations about leadership, especially like just in this work and what leadership looks like. You have to put like the cape down. Like, you have to like put down these pieces so that you can deal with people being mad at you. Like, deal with people having feelings about your work and your thoughts, but not letting it consume you.
I was talking to Loretta Ross a couple weeks ago, who wrote the book on reproductive justice.
And yes, the mama of reproductive justice, for sure.
I mean, she's so full of wisdom. I asked her a bunch of questions about how she's basically kept it going for a half century. Like, how do you maintain your optimism from being at the beginning and Roe v. Wade being the letter of the law to where we are now? How did you even just sustain your energy through all the trials and tribulations along the way?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she was like, well, one, just sort of constitutionally as a person, like, you know, I never let success go to my head and I never let failure go to my heart. And she was like, this is my advice to young people. She says, to never imagine yourself as a whole chain of freedom, that you're not responsible for like what your ancestors did. You're not responsible for what your descendants will do. Your job is to make sure that the chain doesn't break at your link. And so she's like, you know, like my philosophy is like, when the world's a mess, grab a broom and clean up where you are. To me, that's really grounding and centering, because it's like,
for sure.
Yeah. Like, no matter what happens, even if you crash and burn, I've had a few of them in my career. The duty and the goal is to get up again and clean up where you are, whatever that looks like.
That's a word, because it is so easy. Like, so right now I'm on an Instagram break. And so my team is handling my Instagram, but like, I'm not on there. And a part of that was just like, it's too much, right? And like, just seeing like this amount of information, which we're just not meant to consume information at this level. But a part of it is like, I am a doer, right? So like, when I see things, I just want to do, I want to help, I want to jump in, right? But also realizing that in that process of doing that, I've like burnt myself out and all this other kind of stuff, right? And so like, in the last year, I've really been working on just like being where I'm at and doing what I can in the space that I am. And you know, like, I can't, it, versus like stretching myself, like, too much. And I think also too, just as a Black woman, also at the March of Dimes panel. Mm-hmm. So when we're at the March of Dimes panel, someone asked a question around what could people do to support like people like myself doing this work or whatever, leaders, quote unquote. And my answer was, just don't project busyness on me. Like, don't project, like, every time there's an issue that comes into the world, you're like sending it to me. Don't project that. Don't project the idea that I have to be like, you know, being a martyr all the time, that I have to be doing the work 24/7 and that I have to be aware of every hospital situation, every case, everything. I'm like, don't project that on me, because I can only do what I can do from where I'm at. And I think sometimes that thought process, like, it can be frustrating. I imagine, knowing you, that you sometimes have frustration over, I can't do everything.
Sure. Yeah.
But also, like, in these roles, we have to have rest. And so how are you handling this rest part, Neil?
Not as well as I could. I mean, like, I let off with, you know, being a dad, because I think like family is not zero sum. You get back much more than you put in. And so even if you're like running around like crazy, that's sort of like the grounding that I've got. But I think there's two things. I think there's a necessary rest and restoration part of leadership. And then I also think that maybe there's another kind of protective like effort that I've got to figure out that I don't totally know yet. But I think I've been trying to figure out over time, because I like Instagram, for example, like it seems like coming off of Instagram for you is like just putting a protective boundary in place. Right. And I think that's got to be part of it too. I don't know exactly what that looks like for me, but
we got to find something.
Fine. It's fine. But you know, like, we've had a lot of conversations about, you know, how to maintain energy through the long haul. Cause it is a long haul. I think that's the other thing, is like, change doesn't happen in a minute, you know, and along the way you get these milestones where you can just celebrate that, you know, how much progress you've made. It's really not until like the long arc of time that you get to look back and you're like, okay, you know,
And change is happening. Like I was in Arizona yesterday. One of the things that we were talking about though, so we're talking about death and this and that, whatever, but we're also talking about queer elders. And so one of the things that came up around that is like, it's so amazing to me around like how younger generations, like I'm 33 and like 20s, 18 year olds, whoever, that they are so into the work already. I didn't find this work until I was like 26, 27. But it's like, it's wild to me to see like younger generations that have a foundation, right, around inclusion and equity and anti-racism and all these things that I gathered in my 20s, you know, like really naming, like, I want to be a doctor and this is the way that I want to make impact. I want to be a doula and this is the way I want to do this. And so like, when I have those moments of being like, this change is taking such a long time, I really can look at younger generations and be like, oh, okay, something's happening. something is happening. It may not be like in my visual right now, but when I look at them, I'm like, okay, I see what we're doing. Does that make sense?
It does make a lot of sense. Yeah. And I can't imagine that, like, you know, if we're talking about birth equity specifically, that our movement is so much different from other meaningful progressive movements that...
For sure.
And there's a lot tied into it, right? There's gender equity, racial equity, geographic equity, generational equity. There's all kinds of things that are intersecting in our movement. But, you know, I think about, like, there's a book that's on my stand over here on, it's called Let the Record Show. And it's about HIV AIDS activism and really ACT UP, which was the community-based organization in New York that was stood up in the late 1980s, because HIV AIDS was a terrifying new epidemic, mm-hmm. pandemic, truly terrifying, that disproportionately impacted people who were marginalized, disenfranchised as a result. And the Reagan administration didn't care. Pharmaceutical companies didn't care. They were giving them like leftover chemotherapy that didn't even work. People were dying in droves and terrifying. It was horrible. And ACT UP was formed as a community-based organization that, you know, if you read all the famous plays and all you know, it looks like a very quote unquote like clean movement where they had all these major successes. They got AZT passed. They dropped mortality by like 70%. They make it so that in 2022, you can't do HIV AIDS research without community accountability. You need to have a community advisory board. They change public health forever and all these amazing things. And also inside the movement, according to this book, it's like an oral history of all the people who were there. Inside the movement, it was chaotic. You know, there were Yale educated white men that were the spokespeople, and they didn't represent everybody. You know, there were gay men, but there were also lesbians or also like people of color in the movement, and they all didn't see things the same way. And, you know, what the author of the book tries to show in a lot of color is that what mattered the most was what she called the simultaneity of response, that everybody was moving towards progress at the same direction at the same time, even though they didn't necessarily all feel like they needed to do it the same way.
No, that makes so much sense. That's literally like what I hope for the community and the work that we do, that we are able to look at our similarities and the mission that we're going for. Like, there is a common goal, right? And less into the ways that we differ, right? Because we're going to. Like, there's opinions all the time about, I don't know, abortion and this and that, whatever. But I'm like, I do generally believe that everyone wants to be healthy and they want to be happy and they want to be held and they want to have what they need. And like, and if we could focus on that instead of the differences so much, like, where could we go, you know? And yeah. And also I was thinking about this, I wanted to thank you, because we had a conversation like a few months ago, and I think we're talking about like venture capital and just like all types of stuff we'll be talking about. And one of the things that you said to me was like, my gift is that I'm like able to be like this bridge between two worlds, right? Like, I know people that have a lot of money, do a lot of money, move totally in a different way. And I also know the people who are relentless and doing the work on the ground and getting things done. And like, I'm like in that middle space somewhere. And so I've really been like sitting with that. Like, when you told me that, I was like, huh, okay. And so like, even in some times of like struggle, right? I think sometimes like when we're figuring out the how to the goal that we're getting to, right? You have to remember the why, right? And like when I'm going through my moments, when I'm like, how is this not working? And why is this so difficult? And whatever the case is, I remember like people like yourself telling me things that helps me to understand the why. So I want to thank you for that.
Oh, it's very true about you. I think it's very, very unique. And it's also a really hard thing to occupy more than one space. Also, it is like, if there's a call to action from this conversation, like that is what we must do for all kinds of reasons, not just to break down silos, but honestly, creativity for me across my whole career, it's not like magic that you just conjure. It comes from sitting in two spaces that don't normally sit next to each other. That always bears fruit, you know, and it also helps you not read futility into all the chaos.
Yes. Yes. It's a very special place to be in. But I think, you know, I feel very blessed that like I have people like yourself that I can talk to about certain things that like this other person may not know. Right. And but also it's because of my conversations with you and other people, it's like I'm able to bring that into conversations with people that may not have that access, right? So I'm able to bring in their perspective. And this is why like I have you on in the space to like have a perspective that is based in, yes, your work, your career, but also in your humanness, right? Because it's so easy in this work to just see each other's object, to see each other as like, this is just your title. You're a doctor. You're a doula. You're this, right? And to forget about the humanness that also it's spinning in that, right? So like being in that space is hard sometimes, but there's literally nothing else that I would rather do. Do you feel that way about your work?
No, I agree with that. I think definitely it feels like you're winning life when you lock onto a mission that feels like your true north, right? But then to me, it's like, there's nothing more gratifying than trying to translate and have it land. Like, you know, generally speaking, when I look at the world, I'm like, in 2022, the biggest cause of suffering is not lack of knowledge anymore. We all have room to discover things. There's room for us to all become more educated. And also for all of the discovery and education in the world, the biggest cause of suffering is not lack of knowledge, it's lack of execution. And so like to get there, we need people who are willing to translate and walk through walls. But like to walk through walls, the actual work of it is like, you know, to translate. And it's I think it's not trivial, but I think intentionality here really matters. You know, like you've got to actually try. And like when I think about the people who hold the most power in our country, the people who will or will not be elected tomorrow morning, you know, they are like astronomers looking through a telescope at a planet that birth workers live on.
Yes.
Right. So they can make global inferences, but they have no idea what it's like to live on that planet. And so like the only way, like they have the most power. So how do we want to change things? We've got to tell them that we've got to help them understand what it's like to live on the planet. Like, you know, all they can do is look through the telescope. So that's very clearly what we need to do. And for me, like when that happens and there's moments of clarity, that's like the most gratifying thing. Like when I look back on my career, when I'm retired one day, like those are the things I think will stand out.
Yes, I totally agree with that. And I think, yes, you brought it in for me because I like sometimes I'm like, why do I have conversations with people that are so far removed, right? And sometimes like their removal can also sometimes look like disrespect or look like not caring, but it's just a lack of being able to connect, right? With like that, like you said, being an astronomer, you just don't, you're not on the planet, you just see it. And I think that's like, you know, why we do the work is like, how do we create these moments of clarity? Because I just don't inherently think that people are evil. Like I don't. But I think that there is a lot of people who want to do good, who want to be impactful to their community, who want to support, who want to see change, but they have to understand what is needed. And why it's needed.
Honestly, I mean, I feel like I agree. Like human beings are fundamentally decent. We're collectively horrible. We're fundamentally decent, right? And so like, I feel like the canonical problem of all of human progress is translation. Like if it's technology, it's like, okay, Henry Ford invents the Model T. We have assembly lines for the first time. And then like there's people that work on machines and people that work on human beings. And we need to translate between the two. And so we invent the new field of industrial engineering. Technology businesses, we didn't have graphical user interfaces until Windows 95. And so engineers and designers were both in technology companies and they didn't know how to talk to each other. So they invented a new type of role called the product manager, you know, and like there's something like totally equivalent in healthcare that we haven't cracked yet, where we've got these subject matter experts, these deep, deep subject matter experts. And then we have these like operators building businesses, writing policy, doing all these things that shape our society. And we've got a translation problem.
That part, that is the thing. And don't worry, I'm working on it.
I know you are.
I'm working on it. I'm like, if y'all just talk to each other and understand what each other is saying, and we could be a lot, right? But we have to have that part. So my last question to you is, what are you most excited about in our field of birth equity? Like, what is kind of like exciting you, motivating you? Because it's a lot of things that are happening that's really depressing right now, but what is the thing right now that's like exciting you and like waking you up in the morning?
I would say, you know, I'm equally excited by problems worth solving as, you know, tangible progress being made. But I would say, you know, I'm in Maven Clinic right now because I don't think that an app is going to fix healthcare, right? Like an app isn't going to fix structural racism. And also healthcare is stuck in, like while we evolve, you know, pharmaceuticals and various forms of technology, we're still using beepers and faxes. The average person in the world is holding onto a smartphone. And the reason they're holding onto it is because it's access to information and other human beings. And if we're not deploying that to make people healthy, like what are we doing? So I'm really, really excited about the potential of digital health. Like you can't deliver a baby through a screen and like you can't replace like what has to happen in person. But I really think that, you know, you can only get so much done to make people healthy with a few days in a hospital and a few 15-minute appointments. Like we have to be able to meet people in the homes and communities and workplaces where they're actually living their lives. And I think that's going to happen through their phone. So I'm like energized every day by fleshing out a vision for what that looks like and then trying to execute against it to try and meet people where they are.
That part, technology is amazing when it's used in a way that is really, right. You know, in alignment with like putting people first, right? Like when it's used in that way to really create access, to create conversation, to bring education, all those things, like it's really fucking good.
So, yeah, there's nothing inherently good or bad or like evil or, you know, even heroic about technology, but it's like, I don't know. I feel like we're not trying to split the atom or anything. We're just trying to take the devices that people already are carrying around in their pockets and turn it into a portal into the human being that they need to connect with to get the help that they need. That's energizing.
Yeah, so true. It's making me think of so many like companies that are also doing that work, like Poppy Seed. And yeah. I have to tell you about this company, Mylua, that I've been like in conversation with. Have you heard about them?
No.
I'll send you information. But now I'm all in my techie brain because I did a VC fellowship?
Yes. That okay. I mean,
that's
among other things. And you wrote a book on the side and you've got a bunch of other stuff going on. I know.
Listen, Neil, I am who I am. I get excited. I get excited about this work and I get excited about creating things that give other people opportunities.
Well, I agree with all that. And for people who might be listening, I guess like it's a great example of just like, you know, probably you're not listening to this unless you like have a strongly held mission to make a difference for the people who need the help the most because of the way society is or, you know, and like mm-hmm. you're already doing the work day to day. You're probably listening to this, like looking for motivation or energy. I guess like my perspective is, and part of how we even found each other is like, you put yourself out there, like I promise you in the long arc of time, it's going to make a really big difference. Like you're probably already making a difference day to day for the people you're supporting with their birth.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. And also just by virtue of doing that work and just using your mission and your energy and putting it out into the world, you're making a tremendous difference.
And we're doing it together.
And we're doing it together, even if it doesn't always feel that way. We actually are. Yeah. We were doing it together before we even knew each other. So
that part. Well, on that note, I thank you for your time. I'm definitely going to send you something about Mylua though, because I really feel like you'd be interested in their tech and what they're building. Great. And it's also women of color who run it. And you know, that's the whole thing in the tech industry. But anyway, but I thank you for your time. I hope you have a good rest of your day. I guess you got to go and be a doctor or something. I don't know how that works.
Yeah, I've got to go to the next thing. But Sabia, I always love talking to you. So
yes, we will talk soon.
Okay.